The last presidential election was a glaring example, but not the only example, of how Democrats can pile up lots of votes across the country, but still not enough to win control of the presidency or control of legislative chambers at the federal and state level. Republicans control the White House, the U.S. Senate, and the legislatures, both houses, of 30 states. How voters are distributed across the landscape can make a big difference. Our guest this hour boils it down to three words, the title of his book. Jonathan Rodden is the author of Why Cities Lose, subtitled The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Jonathan Rodden is a professor of political science and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also the founder and director of the Stanford Spatial Social Science Lab. Dr. Rodden, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Stanford Spatial Social Science Lab, that's a mouthful right there. Is that just what we're talking about here, though, how the distribution of people in space affects society?
Yes, we've been collecting a lot of data at the lowest levels possible on political behavior. It used to be that we would have just those county-level maps on election night, and those are a lot of fun to look at, and that's kind of what got us started. But one thing we started to understand is that we could put together those data at the level of precincts and then get some geospatial information and really make fine-grained maps of electoral behavior. And that led to a lot of interesting lessons. And we've been doing that in the U.S. and Canada and Australia, and now we're collecting data from a lot of other countries, and we're able to start seeing some really interesting patterns as we zoom in further and further, kind of can see elections in finer detail.
I should point out that even though the dust jacket of the book shows an American map, the fact is you do cover some of those other countries you're talking about, and we get some descriptions about comparisons with the likes of the United Kingdom, in addition to Australia and some other European countries. So lots of good stuff to take in here. I know some people start by suspecting gerrymandering is what results in the party with more votes not getting more results, but it sounds like at least some of the issue is how people distribute themselves.
Yeah, it's a complicated relationship. I mean, it's certainly gerrymandering certainly matters, and the point here is not that not to lose sight of that or not to minimize the importance of it. But in a way, we couldn't really. It's hard to picture how one would go about gerrymandering successfully if Democrats and Republicans were evenly distributed in space or uniformly distributed in space. Having these clusters of very democratic places in cities. Not just big cities, but also kind of small cities and college towns and resort towns and things like that. Having these very blue clusters gives you some blocks to kind of move around and rather carefully craft a map when you're gerrymandering. But one of the things we've learned that I think is sometimes surprising to people is that even if we let a nonpartisan computer algorithm draw the maps and we just try to focus on drawing nice, compact, contiguous, attractive-looking districts, we can still end up with this phenomenon where the Democrats end up in very Democratic districts, and the districts that are majority Republican tend to be a bit more even, a bit more like 55-45 or something like that. So Democrats are just highly concentrated in cities, and that's going to be the case no matter how we draw the districts.
So do Democrats leave rural areas or do rural people leave the party? Have you figured out that relationship?
Well, that's a great question. That's one of the things that I think is still somewhat unresolved. I think that the short answer is that both things are happening. There's almost no doubt about that, the parties have changed. I mean, to me, the most important part of the story is that the parties have changed what they stand for over time. The parties have taken divergent platforms on a growing number of issues. And it just so happens that people's preferences on those issues are correlated with population density. So as the Democrats have taken new positions on issues, social issues like abortion, even before that on race, and then more recently on immigration, and some things about the economy, we've seen that even if no one moves, even if everyone kind of stays put, we see people shifting, rural people shifting toward the Republican Party, and urban people shifting toward the Democratic Party. So that's something that's pretty clear in the data, even if no one moves. And then if we add to that this mobility component, and we imagine that people with certain kinds of preferences are more likely to pick up and move to cities, then that only enhances, it only kind of pushes this even further.
Well, so obviously a party with a lot of urban residents will, focus on issues felt passionately by other urban residents, and therefore somewhat against the wishes of people who live in more open spaces.
Right, and that's one of the dangers of having just a two-party system, just having two big clumps. The danger is that, you know, as we've seen over time, and I think we see something similar in Australia and Canada and the UK, that over time, the party that kind of gets a foothold in cities just becomes more and more urban in its orientation, and then the party that has gotten a foothold in rural areas becomes more and more rural, and we end up with just these two parties that represent these different kinds of geographic places. And it leads to this thing that we call polarization, and leads to a rather unhealthy kind of political dialogue.
Jonathan, you say it is more accurate to refer to urban versus rural than left versus right. Why?
Well, when I think of left versus right, I'm kind of thinking of an initial use of those terms in the early 20th century, in the era of labor mobilization in cities, where when people talk of left and right, they were talking about how big should the government role be in risk sharing and redistribution, and what is the optimal tax rate. And that is, for much of the post-war period, that's what people meant by left and right. But over time, we've added all these other issues, and I just mentioned some of them, you know, each of which the Democrats end up taking the urban perspective on these other issues. And what it means, you know, what we even mean by left and right seems to have changed, so that nowadays if I ask my students, are you to the left or are you to the right, they usually interpret that as a question about abortion and gay rights and, you know, immigration, issues like that. And that's kind of how people now think of left and right. And so it's really come to be the case that the Democrats are this party of a variety of, that kind of pulls together a variety of urban interests. And some of them are, you know, some of these urban voters in places like San Francisco are actually very high income.
We have to take a break here. Hang on just a second. Jonathan Rodden, sure. Our guest, his book is Why Cities Lose, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is political scientist Jonathan Rodden from Stanford University. He's the founder and director of the Stanford Spatial Social Science Lab, which looks at how people are distributed across the landscape and why that leads to the kinds of decisions they make. And it comes into politics when he looks at, well, his book is called Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, about the idea of wasting votes in cities because Democrats are so heavily concentrated there and not so much concentrated in other areas. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to continue on the thought of left and right, or rather urban versus rural. So basically what you've got reflected here in the two parties now is that a lot of concerns that people get in urban areas are reflected in the positions of the Democratic Party, and the concerns of rural areas are reflected in the platforms and issues of the Republican Party.
That's right. It's just been, and that's been kind of something that's increased over time, to the point where, you know, now the correlation between the population density and the voting behavior is just incredible when we look around the country.
How does the way, Jonathan, in which we elect legislators contribute to the situation?
Well, we use, as everyone knows, we use single-member districts. So we take California, we take Oregon, and we divide them up into a series of districts where there's one winner in each district. And we do that in different ways. We do it in the state legislatures. We draw some relatively small districts. And then for Congress, we draw some really large districts, on the order of 700,000 people, which are much larger than many other countries. And that's something that that puts us in, that we have in common with Great Britain and with other former British colonies. So Canada does this, Australia does this. But a lot of other advanced industrial countries do something very different, which is some form of proportional representation, where instead of having a lot of small districts with one winner, they have much larger districts, which each district elects several seats, and those seats are allocated in proportion to the vote share of the parties. So that typically means we end up with, in a place like the Netherlands or in Sweden, with a lot of political parties. We don't end up with just two big bundles. And I think that helps diffuse a little bit, you know, the growth of just an urban and a rural bundle around which politics is organized. It's not really quite organized in such an urban-rural fashion in a place where there are five or six political parties.
So you have to reach across the aisle a bit more when there are more aisles, for example.
Well, right, and it's also the case that that people in cities in places like Amsterdam or places like Stockholm, it's not the case that they vote exclusively for parties of the left. There are parties that are somewhat hard to classify because they are on the economic issue, maybe center-right. They people feel that the Swedish welfare state is sufficiently large and the tax rate is sufficiently high. But they're also very, very progressive on issues like gay marriage and abortion. So you have parties of that kind. They call themselves liberal parties often. And those parties do very well in cities. And you could imagine a party like that doing well in some high-income pockets of American cities like San Francisco. But instead, we're all just organized around this one single divide. And when we have a government of the right in the U.S., that means a government that has really no representation of cities whatsoever. And at the same time, when we have a government of the Democrats, it's overwhelmingly an urban coalition. And then in both situations, the other side really feels completely frozen out, which makes the stakes feel really high.
So it's for understanding this, we go back in time a bit in the book. You bring this back to the Industrial Revolution, and it looks like Democrats actually map fairly closely with 19th century trunk line railroads, which is interesting that we're still talking about this being in a case in the 21st century. It hasn't varied much over more than a century.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought was fascinating, and one of the real payoffs to getting the data at really low levels, because you can kind of look at where those old rail lines were, and especially in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest, you can see those rail lines running between the big manufacturing cities, and you look at these smaller manufacturing cities like Lima, Ohio, and Bryan, Ohio, and Jackson, Michigan, and places like that, and these places are still overwhelmingly Democratic. So then the question that you suggest, you know, there's an interesting puzzle there. Why such a long legacy of something that happened in the early 20th century or sometime late in the 1800s? And, you know, I think there are a variety of ways to think about it. But I think the most important one is that when those factories were built and when the industrial economy was taking off, a lot of housing was built for workers in proximity to those railroad tracks. And so you have rental housing, low income, smaller units that are closer together. And that continues to attract poor people. It continues to attract immigrants, people from other places. And, of course, during the Great Migration, it attracted African Americans in search of work. And so as the party system has evolved, those places have become and stayed very Democratic. But there's another interesting part of it, which is that perhaps there's still just a legacy of labor unions. One thing we know in political science is that a really good predictor of your partisanship is what your parents' partisanship was. It is sort of passed along in some families a bit like religion. And I think we still see the legacy of that.
So my grandparents and parents were Democrats or Republicans, and that's what I am?
Obviously, it's not perfect. People might be sitting at home thinking, "Wait a minute, my father is I'm completely the opposite of my father." There's a lot of heterogeneity in this, but we do see that kind of pattern in the survey data. When we look at long panels of questions following people over time, and we ask them about their parents, it does appear there's a fairly strong relationship, and it does pass along in families on average.
Jonathan Rodden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, political scientist and author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. It's not really surprising you chose to spend some time focusing on Pennsylvania, the joke about Philadelphia in the east, Pittsburgh in the west, and Alabama in between. But what about Reading, Pennsylvania, in particular, draws you in closer?
Well, I was interested in Reading in part because it was sort of this, it was this place that in the early part of the 20th century looked a lot more like a European city in that it developed a socialist party. And it was a place of labor union activism, and it developed a kind of a socialist alternative well before the Democratic Party came along. And so it looked a lot like a European country, but then we can also sort of follow the demise of the Socialist Party and understand, you know, this is part of the story of why the U.S. ended up kind of different than a lot of European countries, where the rise of these socialist parties is actually a big part of how they ended up developing systems of proportional representation. But eventually, the Democrats, in the short version of the story, the Democrats come along and sort of steal their thunder, and the Democrats start to take over those groups of, you know, would-be socialists in places like Reading or places like Milwaukee, other places that had a lot of German immigrants that were sort of moving in the direction of the socialists. These places end up becoming Democratic strongholds. But the real difference between the Democrats and these socialist parties is that the Democrats were many things to many people. And in that period, they were also the party of racial oppression in the South, at the same time that they became the party that mobilized urban workers in places like Reading.
Which raises a question, and it's a bit of a timeout, actually, from the overall discussion here about the way that the political parties seemed so relatively central, both of them. I mean, the old Ralph Nader in his early days, even before he ran for president, talking about there's not a dime's bit worth of difference between the two parties. Was that the anomaly? I mean, have they reverted to an earlier form here, or are we developing something new in our time?
I think a lot of people, when they look back at the parties historically, we look at levels of polarization in the legislature. One of the things that appears to be the case is that a pretty pronounced type of polarization was there in the past, and then it fell away for a while, and now it's back. And it may be that this is a bit more the natural state of things, and that the period of bipartisanship in the 60s and 70s and kind of into the 80s was a bit more of an anomaly.
I wonder if that was a holdover from World War II, where we had a common enemy, and then, of course, we had the concern about the Red Menace in the early years of the Cold War, and that sort of kept everybody aligned the same way or in similar ways.
Yes, it seems like there was a real... Well, I mean, it's a complicated story. I think that there's also in the 60s and 70s, there was a kind of a denationalization of politics, in the sense that one of the things I see in the book is that the Democrats in presidential elections, they've actually always been, you know, ever since the New Deal, they've been concentrated in cities. But in congressional elections, they've been much less so. So the Democrats have been able to run on a variety of different platforms in different places. They've been a really, you know, a party that didn't really have a national platform until fairly recently. And so maybe one of the things that's changed starting in the 90s is that we've all come to view politics as a more kind of as a battle between two groups who have very different plans, and where the control of the Congress is at stake every 2 years. And in the 70s and 80s, the Democrats were able to run candidates who really had their own platforms in their district. They tailored their platform toward their voters in a district, and they weren't kind of caught up in these national battles. So I think part of the story is this denationalization in the past and now a nationalization of politics currently.
Does that come, for example, from Newt Gingrich and the contract with America in 1994 and the idea that he was going to run a national campaign for taking over Congress rather than a bunch of local races?
I think so. I think that's a big, that's an important moment in the development of this nationalization. And in some ways, it was a very smart strategy. It made sense for the Republicans to try to nationalize politics in this way, because it then makes it, it makes it much harder to be a Democrat in suburban Salt Lake City and try to kind of disentangle your platform from the national platform. And it gives Republicans an edge in a lot of pivotal suburban districts. And since then, they've really started to dominate in controlling the legislature.
Jonathan Rodden, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, political scientist at Stanford University, the author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Larry in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Excuse me. Yeah, it's a very complex issue, and you guys could spend hours. But as I'm sitting on the phone here, just a couple real quick things, even just the last couple of minutes, this idea that the Republicans can dominate because of the suburbs, that was exactly the opposite in this last midterm election. The Republicans who were outvoted out, mainly in suburban districts, were tied to the Republican administration in Washington. And they lost heavily. So I think that works both ways. And obviously the speaker, and I'm all for your intellectual nature and your study of these things, but has an agenda about this proportional representation and third parties, fourth parties, sixth parties. But for example, 2000, I really doubt that if Ralph Nader hadn't gotten all those votes in Florida, that Al Gore would have gotten involved and invaded Iraq. Or 1968, if George Wallace hadn't won all those southern states and Hubert Humphrey, I really doubt that Hubert Humphrey would have run a secret government like Richard Nixon did. I'm a great believer in the two-party system, mentioned Pennsylvania, grew up there, never felt left out was the word the speaker used. We had great Democratic administrations who most in this Harrisburg governor, and those are the things that mostly affect people's daily life anyway.
Right.
Get up to the federal administration. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I'm just saying.
As a liberal in Oregon, I've never felt when George Bush was president or anything left out. That great Democratic governors, as we do right now, do you guys feel left out with Tate Burr? We have some of the most liberal policies, and we have a horrible, horrible rightist administration in Washington.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Larry. Appreciate that. Some thoughts from you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think the first point is a very good one about the shifting suburbs. And this is something I discuss in the final chapter of the book. You know, the book is looking back over a long period of time, and it's pointing out a pattern. But there are some good reasons to question whether that pattern might be changing. Pattern that in question is that it's always been hard for the Democrats to win in the pivotal suburban places, in part because their platform has been perceived increasingly, especially after the Gingrich Revolution, has been perceived as very, very urban. And the ideological distance between the urban districts and the pivotal suburban districts was great. But now, in the era of Trump, there's a possibility that the problem of having your platform really come to be dominated by your base can be damaging on both sides. And this last midterm election was one in which the economy is doing well. Of course, we always see a loss for the president's party in the midterm. But this was an extremely large loss. And as the caller points out, it was especially pronounced in the pivotal suburban districts. So it's possible that the Republican Party in the era of Trump is sort of losing this advantage that it's had for such a long time. By losing some of the educated suburbs, that's really where the Republicans' strength has been in winning legislatures. So it's possible that they're kind of killing this goose that laid this golden egg for decades.
We talked about the tracking of Democratic voters with railroad lines, primarily in Rust Belt states, and that seems to be holding on, a lot of legacy voting perhaps. So what is the story where manufacturing is alive and well now? What are the voting patterns like there? How do they compare with the old manufacturing centers?
Yeah, that's another really interesting pattern, in that it's an instance where we can do better using data from a census from the 1880s or from the 1920 census. When we look at the correlation between manufacturing as a share of employment and voting, we see that historical manufacturing is strongly correlated with Democratic voting today. But then if we get into the current census and we look at, well, where is the manufacturing now, we see the opposite relationship, that places that have more manufacturing employment today, which are, you know, these are different places. So manufacturing has really moved. It's no longer in city centers and along those railroad lines. It's now more in the South and in exurban areas along highways in the Midwest. And those places now tend toward the toward the Republicans. So there's been a real shift in the correlation between manufacturing activity and partisanship.
So let's bring in the union angle here. Is manufacturing doing well now in places where unions are relatively weak compared to what they're like in the Rust Belt?
Well, doing well in the sense that it's holding on, you know, that it's surviving, that there's still manufacturing activity. Part of the problem, though, is that manufacturing in these places, that and these are less unionized places. A big part of the movement of manufacturing was to escape labor unions in places like Reading. I mean, Reading, Pennsylvania, is a place that had in the New Deal. Thereafter, had a big labor mobilization, and then the factories quickly moved away to the South. Those places now where that received that manufacturing are more Republican, and Reading itself is still very Democratic.
Just a quick question on the way to the break. Have you seen the play Sweat by Lynn Nottage?
No, I've not.
It focuses on Reading, Pennsylvania as well.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so something to see the next time you get a chance to get to the theater. Jonathan Rodden, our guest. His book is Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Jonathan Rodden, professor of political science and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He studies the distribution of people across the landscape and how that affects society. And he's looking at the urban-rural split in America as it relates to politics. His book is called Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. You can join the conversation on the exchange and talk about why Democrats are clustered in cities and why Republicans are not. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've established some patterns that generally the in the North, in particular, the old manufacturing centers, there tend to be a lot of Democrats in those cities, not so much in the South. And I have a question specific to the 2016 election, and that is, did Hillary Clinton do especially badly outside the norm, for example, with manufacturing workers anywhere in the country?
Well, the losses for the Democratic Party in non-metro areas compared to 2008 and 2012 were quite large. Her performance in rural areas was substantially worse than Obama's had been in 2008 and 2012, and that certainly made a difference in some of the pivotal states. But it's important, though, to make this kind of careful distinction between when we think about a rural county, for instance, that turns out to be a really heterogeneous thing. You can have a city center, a small old manufacturing city in one of these places that still votes very Democratic, and that was still the case in 2016. Many of those old industrial towns still voted majority Democratic. There was a little bit of a misunderstanding about that, I think, in the media. But I think your question was about change over time. And indeed, in places like Johnstown, Pennsylvania, even though like the urban core of Johnstown, I think, was still majority Democratic, it was a big fall off from the previous elections. So there was a real decline in those in those communities, not just the very rural places. The biggest losses were in the rural places, but there were also some losses even in those cities themselves.
We've talked a lot about manufacturing thus far, but you do get into the knowledge economy in the book and people involved in tech and higher education and have more degrees, that sort of thing. What is the trend there in how people who inhabit the knowledge economy, work in the knowledge economy, vote?
Yes, that's something that is, I think, an important trend, not just in the U.S., but in several other countries as well. It's kind of an interesting story. It's maybe now starts to seem natural, but when you really think about it, why should the party of these industrial workers from the early 20th century have morphed into the party of educated professionals today? And I think it's hard to understand that without understanding the political geography, that just as there were these agglomeration economies, that the reasons why it made sense for manufacturing to be highly concentrated in space, the same thing is true, similar arguments about why knowledge economy employment is concentrated in space in certain kinds of cities. And then over time, then, the question is, how did it come to be that these left parties ended up the parties of the knowledge economy? I think part of the story is just this same old story about once the party of the left is successful in cities, it starts to develop new clientele in the cities. And it starts to, in Massachusetts and Boston, the Democrats started to form alliances with these entrepreneurs at Harvard and MIT. And this nexus between the knowledge economy and the Democrats was born, and it's played out in a similar way in California. But I think it's also true that knowledge economy workers and educated these college graduates who are moving for opportunity to these cities also have different social preferences. They have distinctive social preferences, and on that dimension as well, these cities have become quite distinctive.
So the another question then about general trends within parties, the post-Reagan realignment seems like it would have been inevitable. We had a lot of people leaving the Democratic Party, particularly in the South, for the Republican Party. But it seems like you could not logically expect an increasingly ethnic and urban Democratic Party to be home for most Southern whites for a whole lot longer.
Right, and it's in some ways it's surprising that the alignment was as slow, realignment was as slow as it was. It's still not even complete, and in some parts of the South there's still Southern Democrats hanging on in state legislatures and county offices and so forth.
So in this context then of realignment, I mean, I'd love to get into these chicken and egg sorts of things about which came first. Did the GOP appeal to Christians, or did Christians appeal to the GOP?
Yeah, that's another kind of good and sort of controversial question, and it's a question that I think requires a pretty nuanced view of the history of how that happened. It does seem that there are some historians have made the claim that it's hard to disentangle this with discussions of race, and that the initial some of the initial mobilization of the evangelical movement in politics had to do with segregated schools in the South, and then this is where the kind of growing relationship between the Republican Party in the South and evangelicals, that it kind of started on this issue and then expanded into others. But I haven't done that kind of careful historical research to be able to answer that question in a satisfactory way.
Okay, I do have some more questions about the morals and politics, but I want to bring a caller in here. Jake in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jonathan Rodden, the author of Why Cities Lose.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a simple solution to gerrymandering. And if you look at some of these intricate patterns that are being done by algorithms, it looks kind of like a snake, married a dumbbell and they're eating an elephant. You know, it's very, very specifically mapped out. If you look at a map of the United States, the 48 states, you see that predominantly most you could best see it in the western states, but all states, maybe 80% of them, are rectangular or square. And there's some distinctions that are like geographic, because the Texas border with the Rio Grande River, does that oblique thing. But my proposal is that all voting districts be shaped in the basic predominant squares and rectangles, just as all states and just as all counties are, and none of this shenanigans regarding, like, snakes and dumbbells.
Okay, thanks for the thoughts, Jacob. Appreciate that. Although I was, you know, prodded to think about that Pennsylvania 7th District, the goofy-kicking Donald Duck outline. But come on in here, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I that's one of the things that we've tried to do some, get a better understanding of is, well, you know, obviously we have to have population equality. The court is very clear about that, that the districts have to be within a very narrow population window, and so it's, you know, they can't all be equally sized squares. Obviously, the squares in out in rural areas have to be a lot larger than the squares in urban areas. But you know, the basic idea here is that the districts should be compact, and you know, compactness is something that people have been arguing about and trying to measure and comprehend for quite a while. And we've got a lot of mathematicians and computer scientists kind of fascinated by this as well. Like, and I think a lot of people have that intuition that if we just could draw nice, small, you know, geographically and geometrically compact districts, that would be preferable. And I think in many ways it would, but on the just a question of who would this benefit, this would be bad for the Democrats. If we just drew these kind of compact districts in cities, you would still end up with districts that were 75-80% in some cases Democratic in cities, and you would end up with a 55% Republican districts in many rural areas. But that's, you know, that's I think for lots of folks, that's not really much of an issue. As long as it's kind of procedurally fair, then the parties should try to just adjust their strategies accordingly. And that's really the debate. I think we're going to continue to have that debate. Lots of states, voters in lots of states are going to be having that debate. I don't think the courts are going to solve this issue. I think it'll be up to voters in different states to choose some kind of a redistricting proposal that is different from, you know, members of the majority party drawing the districts to their advantage. And something like the caller's proposal is something that's being taken seriously in lots of places.
Yeah, so we're certainly dealing with how district lines are drawn and will for the rest of time, probably, certainly as long as we have single district representation. Let's come into the moral versus economic qualities of the urban-rural split, because it seems like that's pretty much you vote your pocketbook in the cities and you vote your morals in the country. Is it that defined?
Well, I think it. I wouldn't put it that way. I think if we look at people in San Francisco, they're not voting their pocketbooks. You know, there are lots of people in very wealthy places that contribute in quite large numbers to the federal budget. I mean, one interesting fact is that in the most recent data we have, the two-thirds of federal income tax come from the counties that were won by Hillary Clinton in 2016. So we've got lots of Democrats who are high income, who pay a lot in taxes, who are voting, you might argue, against their economic interests. So I think there's some kind of, you know, some not purely economic interest-based voting going on both sides.
So I'm curious to know, in a hypothetical where a candidate says, I'll make you all rich here in the countryside, is this person still going to lose among rural voters if he or she favors abortion rights, for example? I mean, it's a very black and white kind of example, but what do you think?
I think that probably varies a lot from one place to another. I think there are a lot of single issue voters out there, but at the same time, I think that we probably overestimate the extent to which people have really crystallized, polarized preferences, even on the abortion issue. It really depends on how you ask the question, and it seems that most Americans are somewhere in the middle, believe it or not, on this issue. In that they don't believe it should be completely outlawed in all instances, and they don't believe that it should just be easy and free. They believe that some kinds of government restrictions are acceptable. So. People are a bit more, I think it's possible for someone with a nuanced platform on abortion to be elected in these kinds of districts. I think if people are perceived, you know, in a very rural district, if they're perceived as having an extreme platform that is similar to the most extreme urban Democrat, then that does make it hard for them.
Jonathan, I want to ask about the pivot counties of 2016 that voted for Obama 4 years earlier and then went heavily for Trump. Windham County, Connecticut, just across the river from where I went to high school, is one of them. This is a place where manufacturing, the textile industry died a while ago. I just wonder if the major factor for places like that were that their existence was really acknowledged by a presidential candidate for the first time in a while.
Yes, I think that for people who hope to continue the manufacturing, or who had hoped to bring back some manufacturing, and who have suffered from deindustrialization and from globalization and from trade. And this is, by the way, a very similar story in the UK and parts of Europe right now. For a time in the US, it was not clear. There was neither party was really offering them much at all. And especially on trade, if you think about this, not just in terms of acknowledging people's existence, but think about it as policy, I think there are people out there who have been very skeptical about how we've handled the rise of China, but neither party was offering them anything much in the way of an alternative approach. And all of a sudden, a candidate from one of the major parties adopts a very different approach. And I think for people who've been harboring this kind of skepticism about globalization all along, this was really important. So in some ways, it's kind of like a time when, you know, there was a time when it was unclear if you didn't like abortion, which party you should vote for. And then that changed in the 80s. And so when it comes to globalization and free trade, if you were a skeptic, it wasn't clear who you should vote for. Now suddenly that has changed. So I think it's kind of pushed this this kind of urban-rural alignment along even further.
Which is the subject of Jonathan Rodden's book, Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Jonathan, a professor of political science and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the urban-rural divide.
Thanks for having me.